You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. And as you've noticed from our graphic, we are revisiting a classic science fiction film from 1957. Now, the last time we talked about 20 Million Miles to Earth, we were talking about its 60th anniversary. So today, do the math, 5 years later, we are on the eve of its 65th anniversary. That's right, in June of 1957, this film was released to the United States. And it's a favorite of many of us monster kids because it features the incredible stop-motion animation and effects by Ray Harryhausen, a legend in movie history. And this would be an interesting film for Ray because at this point he had done a lot of quote-unquote monster movies and that sort of things, but he was getting a little tired of it. I mean, he goes all the way back to working with Willis O'Brien on King Kong, but he wanted to branch out and do something different. He was very interested in these sword and sandal films, films of the fantastique. And so this would be the last film that he would do as a quote-unquote monster movie. Now, this movie features probably one of the greatest monsters that those of us who were monster kids growing up, this movie so affected me when I watched it. Of course, they all affected me, but I mean, just I was so blown away. I had seen Ray Harryhausen stop motion before, but I think he really outdid himself on this one. And then he would leave this genre and go on and do films like Jason and the Argonauts, The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, and all of those. And in fact, eagle-eyed viewers will probably spot this monster in another film later on that would come out in the early 80s, and one that Madeline and I talked about a couple of years ago, and that's Clash of the Titans. Because when they call out for the Kraken, that Kraken looks an awful lot like this movie's Ymir. Now, I'm going to throw a lot of different facts at you as I talk about my experience watching this film as a kid and as an adult, because it's still a favorite. This film never gets old for me. And I just marvel at still 65 years later how effective these special effects are in here. It really, really is just amazing, even compared to other Ray Harryhausen effects. But you'll notice in 20 Million Miles to Earth, the name Ymir is never used. The monster is only referred to as a Venusian, as a creature from Venus, as an animal, as a creature, whatever. But is never pronounced, they never use the word Ymir, because Harryhausen had a fear that people would see the movie and get it confused with the term Ymir, which refers to royalty in Saudi Arabia and in the Middle East and all of that. So the only time, in fact, I'm trying to remember when I first realized what the name of this creature was, or that it even had a name. I think it was probably in one of my first monster books that it talked about this film, because I had no idea up until that point it actually had a name. So just one of those little facts that we didn't get to, I think, the first time we talked about this film. What an incredible cast. And again, these effects were really great. And the only criticism that I have read about over the years about 20 Million Miles to Earth is that maybe the script isn't the strongest in the world. And again, this is one of those where, 1957 filter comes on. And, we're seeing a spate of monster movies coming out at this time. Now, this wasn't done by Universal. This was distributed by Columbia Pictures. But it again, all of these movie companies were getting into the game. And by the late 50s, and if you think back on the history of Monster Attack, our second season pretty much, I think almost for the entire season, concentrated on monster movies in the mid to late 1950s. That's how prolific this time period was. And just what a great time. And these movies ran in big theaters, little theaters, a lot of drive-in theaters. My mom and dad, when they first met, just haunted theaters looking for monster movies, and a lot of times the drive-ins. So that became a big part of my life growing up. Because, even after I was born and my sister was born, we would continue going to the drive-ins on a regular basis because they showed all the cool movies. So these movies just bring back just a plethora of great feelings and nostalgia for me as a movie watcher. Now, I'm trying to remember the first time I saw this. It was on Monster Movie Matinee, and this film got a lot of showings on the monster movie circuit. Now, I don't believe it was part of the Son of Shock and the Shock Theater package. This came out on a separate package because, most of those were Universal films. But Columbia had its own package as well. So, everybody, like I said, was getting into the game. And they were trying to get onto TV because they realized TV was a treasure trove of finding new audiences, like kids like me and kids, like those of you out there that are my age. So I saw this on Monster Movie Matinee, and I am going to speculate from what I recall, because I had already started building monster models at this time, and I was like 2 years into being a monster kid. So I was like a sponge. I wanted to suck up everything monster that I could get my hands on. And I'm going to say I was about third grade. This was about 1963 when this started making its appearances on television. And I believe that this one may have also made some of the CBS showings. Because again, Columbia was there, Columbia was part of the CBS family, part of the CBS corporation, should I say, or whatever. So they had access to this film's earliest. But I believe I did see this on one of the neutral local stations first, and then later it made an appearance along with a lot of Harryhausen films on CBS and CBS Late Night and stuff. And this film just haunted television for a long, long time. It is very easy to find. I'm going to say that, right up front here for any of you out there that have not seen this film. This is an easy film to find because it's in the public domain. And interesting thing that in 2007, the copyright ran out on this film and it was never renewed. And I'm amazed that this is one of those incredible films that made it into the public domain. So I say that because it's easy to find, but I'm also saying that because be careful that you might get a hold of a bad copy of it. So, it's like with Night of the Living Dead. You've got some really good copies of it and some bad copies. So just be careful. But it was released, it's got some great release points on DVD, where it came out as part of a 50th anniversary of the release of the film. And again, this was in 2007, 2008 when it came out. And also, some of you may remember that in 2008, there was a 4-issue miniseries comic book that also came out by Tidal Wave Productions. That was part of the 50th anniversary as well, and also part of their Ray Harryhausen signature series. And it takes place 50 years after this movie takes place. So it's pretty cool. If you can get a hold of that, that's going to be a little harder to find. But it's well worth a read. It's a lot of fun to pick up where they left off. That, wow, was there more after they killed the Emir in this movie? Oh, yes. Spoiler alert. Yes, the monster dies in this. So we're going to get that right out of the way because we spoiled it already 5 years ago. So we're going to spoil it again if you haven't seen this movie. And if you haven't, why not? Because it's a fun movie. Again, the script is, the script is a typical 1957 monster movie script, or sci-fi monster movie script, because, the science is not solid. It involves man's first visit to the planet Venus. They actually go onto the planet Venus. In 1957, it was, conceivable At the time, we didn't have the science that we have nowadays, so they didn't know that there's no way you were going to survive on the planet Venus. I mean, there's only been one probe, I believe, that has landed on the planet, and it lasted all of like 19 seconds or whatever because the pressure and the heat is so great that, I doubt, I know in my lifetime, we'll never see anybody in a position where they could land on the planet. It's virtually impossible with our current technology. But back then, sci-fi was full of, landings on Mars and Venus and, every planet in our solar system. So it made for fun, because everybody was landing on Mars at this time in the movies. So to make it Venus was sort of cool to me as a kid. I mean, I remember after this, there were very few films that came out that dealt with a manned flight to the planet. And so anytime I, caught one, especially like The Illustrated Man and others like that, I really got into it. I was like, yeah, that's different. That's sort of cool. I believe there was one called The First Spaceship in Venus, and we may have to do a show on that one that dealt with the subject. And that came out in the early 60s as well. So, I mean, this was a lot of fun. You've just put aside, all the scientific stuff and, suspend some disbelief and have some fun with it. This is one where the United States Air Force is behind the project. And, which was, most of our science fiction movies dealing with outer space, had a military type background to it. That's how we visualized that this was going to happen. We never, visualized back then that, you would have a separate space agency, quote unquote, NASA, to take care of all of that. So that's, all of these movies we saw were people in the military that were involved with all of this exploration back then. This was kept quiet. Nobody knew about it. And when the movie opens up, it opens up in a small village in Sicily. And that's where the rocket coming back from Venus that nobody knows about except for the government crash lands. And we'll get into that when we get into the storyline here in just a minute. So this had all the makings of stuff that I was going to really found cool. And I couldn't wait to see this film as a kid, and it did not disappoint. Even with the sort of dopey, the dopey storyline a little bit with, our leading man, played by William Hopper, falls in love with Joan Taylor, who is our leading female actress in this. I mean, but when you look at virtually every sci-fi or monster movie in the 1950s, that was pretty much the case. That was part of the formula. Yeah, the lead guy and the lead gal always fell in love at the end, and and that was it. It was all a big happy ending when the monster was no longer a threat. So, that doesn't bother me anymore. I mean, it almost makes these films very charming when you think about it. William Hopper, of course, those of us who are growing up during this time period, if you were a fan of Perry Mason, you will remember William Hopper as Paul Drake. Big, tall, strapping guy with white blonde hair. And an interesting story behind this, and I don't think I told this story before, but William Hopper was a frogman during World War II. And while serving as a frogman, and he went on some very dangerous missions, wartime missions. And it was said in his biography that the stress was so much, the wartime stress that he encountered, so it was so, so bad that his hair turned white. It was blonde normally, but it turned white. So he had that trademark almost peroxide blonde look. A lot of people thought that he probably peroxided his hair like some women back then did. But no, it was a natural result of stress that he went through in World War II. He was the son of Hedda Hopper. They did not get along. They were mother and son, but they just, he was a little bit of a loner. He claimed in an interview that it wasn't that he didn't like people, but he just preferred being on his own. And he died at a very young age. He had a stroke in 1970 when he was just in his 50s, and that really knocked him down considerably and caused him to finally retire from acting, and then complications from the stroke, later took his life at the age of 55. So I mean, a relatively young guy, but a very, very popular actor as a result of some of his work in movies like this and in other appearances he made. He was in a couple of big films, but mainly known for Perry Mason. And Sven Gulli, I hear Sven Gulli groaning in the background on that. That's a running gag for him. Sven Gulli's got the Perry Mason references, and mine are always the Adventures of Superman. And I think I'm trying to think if I've got an Adventures of Superman reference from this movie. I don't think so. I don't. So you guys are going to be spared that on this episode. Now, our lead female, oh, by the way, William Hopper's character play is Colonel Robert Calder, and he is the commander of this flight to Venus. So he's the big honcho that is in charge of the flight to Venus and the only survivor of a mission that involves 17 people. This is where you've got to suspend disbelief because 17 people in this one rocket ship landing on Venus and coming back. Well, you know, it made for great stories, but even nowadays, we don't have the capabilities of doing a mission like that to any planet, let alone to the planet Venus. But this is what made these films so much fun is the imagination involved and just really, you know, as a kid, I loved it because I visualized what would it be like to leave this planet and go to another planet and explore it and then come back. I mean, just amazing stuff. So let's talk about Joan Taylor real quick. And again, a lot of these names I'm going to be mentioning to you today are very, very familiar to monster movie people, to television people, just a lot of popular actors. Joan Taylor, again, I had a crush on her as well, as many of us did, because she would go from this movie, while she was also in Earth versus the Flying Saucer. She was playing the wife of Hugh Marlowe in that one. In fact, that's another film we may visit because they're coming up on a big anniversary as well. Joan is the ultimate girl next door. That's the best way I can put it. I mean, you know, she's got that kind of beauty and charm. She's the gal you want to bring home to mom. And a very, very pretty gal. And we also have developed, a lot of us my age developed, you know, all of us guys developed crushes on her because she had a 2-year stint on one of our favorite television shows, The Rifleman, where she played one of, you know, the shop owner, and then was replaced down the road. There was like 2 or 3 different women that played in that role, and sort of she was, out of all of the women that appeared on Rifleman, sort of the lightest romantic interest of Chuck Connors' character, Lucas McCain. But so we got to see her every week on that show as well, a few years after this film came out. So Joan got out of acting fairly early on. She got married and they moved to Hawaii, and she decided it was time to raise her family, and they had a couple of kids. And she pretty much was out of acting for a while and then came back in the 80s and did some writing and did make a couple of appearances on a couple of shows, but pretty much, was dedicated to her family life and all of that, and has a great trove of movies for us to watch now all the time. We lost her a few years ago. And again, just a real popular actress for me, watching some of these sci-fis. And two of my favorites, this one, 20 Million Miles to Earth and Earth versus the Flying Saucer. Another one, like I said, we'll revisit it again because it's one that never gets old for me. I can watch that movie over and over and over again. A fellow we haven't talked about in quite a while, Thomas Brown Henry, plays Major General McIntosh, and he's the guy he is the Air Force general who is overseeing this project. And, Thomas Brown Henry, I think the last time we may have talked about him was maybe in Frankenstein 1970. He had an appearance in that. But he also showed up as a general. He always played a general or someone in a figure of authority in Earth versus the Flying Saucer. And he has the best line in the whole movie of Earth versus the Flying Saucer, where he says, you know, when an alien nation or whatever, an alien entity makes threats against us, we don't greet them with tea and cookies or something like that. I know that's terribly paraphrased, but I remember, you know, as a kid getting a kick out of that, and I still get a kick out of it nowadays. Our next actor was actually born in Italy, and we're going to tell you a little bit about why this film takes place in Italy. Frank Puglia. And Frank was as a kid, he toured with the Italian opera And then they moved to the United States when he was about 15 years old. He plays Dr. Leonardo. He's a zoologist who's in Sicily studying various forms of animal life, strange animal life. And Joan Taylor is his niece. And she is, by the way, I should mention, is to become a doctor in about another year, according to the script. So she's an almost a doctor, which William Hopper's character refers to her. Yeah, I would say sort of lovingly little jab in the movie. We'll tell where she comes into play there. But Frank plays Dr. Leonardo, another familiar face. You'll have seen him in How Green Is My Valley was another big film that he did. And an interesting story about Frank, just before he died, he was cast as the Undertaker in the first Godfather film, if you remember, the one where Vito goes and he needs a favor because Sonny has been killed and he needs someone to make him look good for his mother. But he had to drop out of that. He couldn't accept that role because of illness. And then he died a few months after that. So, interesting guy. He just makes appearances all over the place in American cinema. He had quite a career. And again, one of those fellows that you're going to recognize. You may not know his name, but you'll recognize him. Another fellow we haven't talked about in quite a bit, and another veteran of Earth versus the Flying Saucer, which, by the way, came out in 57. So, this is, and also Harryhausen did a lot of the effects for it. So you're going to see a lot of cast carry over into this movie. John Zaremba, I'll always remember, not only for films like this, and he was the guy that walked with the cane in Earth versus the Flying Saucer and is killed by the Martians. But I remember him probably, and a lot of us do, from The Time Tunnel. He was one of the scientists in The Time Tunnel TV show, which I loved growing up. And that was a real, real popular ABC show that came. Boy, ABC at that time was just releasing a lot of cool science fiction and shows of the fantastical. And it was a great time to be into this sort of thing. I compare it now to the last 10 to 15 years now with comic book stuff, because we were all comic book kids too. And so last several years from 2008 on, when it was all all DC and Marvel comic stuff, we were just on TV and in the movies. It was a great time to be alive. Back then it was with sci-fi and fantastical stuff. You had Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, Time Tunnel, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Land of the Giants, which was sort of on the tail end of it. That's when it got a little goofy. Lost in Space and all of those. But John Zaremba, very recognizable. Very, very recognizable. And for those of you who may have grown up in California, he was a spokesman for Folgers. And so you'll recognize him from that. And he's got a very distinct voice, as many of the actors from this time period did. They did a lot of great stuff on radio as well as on TV. And then Arthur Space, who is technically one of the other survivors of this mission, but he dies as a result of the injuries he sustained when the spaceship crashes. Arthur Space, the name may not be familiar to you, but he's a guy very familiar to television. Yeah, oh, wait a minute. Okay, there's an Adventures of Superman reference. Yeah, he was in a couple of episodes of that. But I always remember him as the veterinarian from Lassie, because on Sunday nights, we would watch Lassie followed by The Wonderful World of Disney, or Disney's Wonderful World of Color. I mean, it changed its names many times over the years, but Arthur Space was, just the kindly doctor, the kindly veterinarian in Lassie, and just a very popular character actor, a lot on TV. We see a lot of him on television. We've got a little kid in this one. I know, the times we've talked about Black Scorpion with Mark Maddox, we talk about the little kid in there who causes all the problems for the guys in that movie and nearly gets him killed several times. We've got a character in here like that character Pepe, played by Bart Braverman. And you're like, oh, Bart Braverman, that's a familiar name. Yeah, he did a lot of TV stuff. And for my generation and the generation behind me, will always be remembered as sort of the comic relief character in the television series Vegas. But he made a ton of television appearances and movie appearances. And he started out as a little kid in this. Plays, again, a character by the name of Pepe, who's probably 6 or 7 years old. He's fascinated with cowboys from the United States. He's a little kid who goes selling things that he finds to Dr. Leonardo, and Leonardo sort of, you know, looks the other way and, you know, gives him money for these worthless items. But he does happen to find something that's not worthless in the movie, and it's a major part of the storyline, which we're getting ready to get to right now. But Pepe, you know, uses the money to buy a cowboy hat. And then later on, when the military steps in and he helps them find something they've been looking for from the spaceship, the old major general played by Thomas Brown Henry says, you know, he says, is it going to be enough money to buy a horse? And he says, yep, we're going to buy you a horse. So, you know, that whole cowboy, American cowboy theme. But, he's an American actor all the way around. And had olive skin, really, really nice olive skin. So he always played, you know, either Italians or Mexicans or whatever. So he had quite a career. I mean, still quite a career. He's still with us, and has sort of backed off the acting a little bit. But he was acting right up until 2017, according to his resume. So a very familiar name for anyone that's watched TV in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and then some. So let's get into our storyline. And then I want to talk a little bit about Harryhausen's creations as well. Like I said, the Ymir does look surprisingly similar to the Kraken that appears in Clash of the Titans 2. It is the coolest monster. I remember the first time I saw this movie, it was just such a cool monster. And the thing I want to mention about this, this is an animal or a creature from Venus that is brought back by the crew of this this Venusian exploration mission that William Hopper is leading. The ship crashes. They lose control. It comes diving into the atmosphere, and it ends up falling into the Mediterranean Sea just outside of Sicily. Now, originally, this film was going to take place in Chicago, and the crash was going to be in Lake Michigan. But Ray Harryhausen had always wanted to take a vacation in Italy. And at this point, Ray, he had some clout in Hollywood. And so he goes to the producers and said, let's shoot this in Italy. You know, and I don't think he said immediately, you know, off the top that I want to shoot in Italy so I can go to Italy. But he wanted to go to Italy. And if you notice, later on in his career, he ends up in Italy quite a bit on some of his movies like Jason and some of the others. But this was the first time, and he'd always wanted to go. And they said, okay, yeah, we can do that. Now, originally he wanted to do this in color as well because he thought it would enhance the creatures that he made for this. But they wouldn't go for that. They didn't have the budget to go for color. However, and again, we could get into an argument on colorizing films or whatever, but this film was colorized a few years ago and released. And on this DVD set that I mentioned to you, the colorized version is available there. I have a mixed mind on colorization because I think when these films were shot in black and white, you know, the director and the cinematographer, they shot it and lit them in a way to enhance the black and white. And when you colorize them, if you notice some of the, you know, the Turner Classic movies that are colorized, like Yankee Doodle Dandy, which I did have a copy of in the colorized version as well as the black and white version, it misses something. A little bit, because these films weren't made to be in color. But I haven't seen the 20 Million Miles to Earth colorized version, and maybe I'll do another show if I get to see that. I need to track one down, because this is one that Harryhausen oversaw, and they went to an extensive lengths with the people involved with the film to make it a clean transition to color. So they wouldn't run into some of the problems that some of these other films are seeing, you know, and you can think of some on your own, that movies that you loved that were black and white and were colorized. And then when you saw the colored version, it was like, yeah, I guess so. I don't, you know, it didn't really do much for you. There were some things with Yankee Doodle Dandy that it was really sort of cool to see all the red, white, and blue and stuff. But it had some issues. I mean, there were some quality issues where it was clearly not completely color and not completely black, you know, and it was, you know, the lighting was all wrong and that sort of thing. So I tend to always lean towards the side of watch the film in its original state. That's going to be the best way to see any movie. But I'll give this one a chance because of the effort that went into making it look, you know, so much better. So we'll see. I'll leave that up. And if any of you have seen the colorized version, let me know. Drop me a note and let me know what you thought of it. So let's go on. The spaceship crashes. Pepe and a couple of other, the fishermen in the village, they row out there to help see if anyone, you know, they think there must be someone in there. It's this huge, huge rocket ship. And the two of the fishermen get in there. They find William Hopper and they find Arthur Space's character and the and Arthur Space. Well, they're both unconscious and they are taken to the little village nearby. The doctor is not available because he's delivering a baby in some village, you know, miles and miles away. So that's where Joan Taylor comes into play because they seek out Dr. Leonardo and said, "Oh, there is a doctor nearby. He's doing research out in the country there." Not realizing that he wasn't a medical doctor, but he was a zoologist. But she says, "Well, I'm in medical school. I'll do the best I can." And unfortunately, Arthur Space's character, Dr. Sharman, dies. There's nothing that can be done for him. And when William Hopper's character comes to, Bob Calder comes to, he's all upset. You know, snapping at her, saying, you know, asking questions like, you know, where am I and all this stuff. He finds out he's in a small town in Sicily, you know, and she doesn't know anything about this. And she's asking, trying to ask him questions. And he's like, I can't tell you anything, you know. So it's clear this is a classified type thing. And he's able to get in touch with Major General McIntosh after speaking with some of the officials, the commissioner of the area and the mayor of the town, and McIntosh, as well as John Zaremba's character as well, show up in Italy because they both know from the communication they had during this mission that they were bringing something back, something alive. And that's where Pepe comes into play because he sort of wanders off and he finds this canister floating in the ocean with a big USAF on it, and he opens it up and he finds this thing, and best described as an egg. It's gelatinous, and there's something inside of it. It's sort of, you know, translucent, so you can tell something is in there. And, of course, he goes trotting off to Dr. Leonardo because he figures, hey, I'm going to make some money off this. Gets 200 lira for it, and it's just what he needs for his cowboy hat. And, of course, Leonardo's like, yeah, this is sort of interesting. It looks like, you know, it almost reminds me a little bit of some of the stuff they found in The Monster of the Challenge, The World, which was taken, you know, and they used, you know, actual marine-type biology eggs to inspire them for that one. So I would say that was sort of the inspiration here as well. Well, as you know, to make a long story short, while Bob Calder is recovering in this makeshift hospital under the care of Marissa, played by Joan Taylor, this thing ends up hatching. And so we see little Emer. This little Emer is only about like maybe 2 feet tall, but it is so cool. And of course, again, I don't really probably need to describe it too much, but I mean, it looks human with sort of a monster type head. It has a tail, sort of a scaly body. And again, we're imagining, well, this was taken off the surface of Venus, so it had to adapt itself to the extreme heat. They do mention there's extreme heat on Venus, you know, nothing else. And again, we know now that virtually any kind of life that we understand could never survive on Venus under the conditions, you know, 900 degrees Fahrenheit, and the pressure that's on that planet is just unbelievable. But the thing, I want to make this one just sort of a side commentary on that. When I see the emir and they refer to it as like an alien creature and it's automatically a threat and stuff. And remember, this is late 50s. So there's so much built into these movies about the communist threat, you know, and things, everything is threatening to the United States. But I kept thinking, this is a creature that displays some intelligence. And this is something I really noticed when I watched the film again the other day, More so. I was really sort of looking for that because I said, this isn't really an animal. I don't consider it an animal. It's got a lot of, intelligent qualities about it. And these guys are treating it like it needs to be studied and all this stuff. And they do catch it. It gets loose and it keeps growing and growing and growing. I'm just going to be skipping over the storyline pretty fast because it's a very simple story. But we find that for whatever reason, Bob Calder tells the officials that when they finally release what's going on, that this was a spaceship trip to Venus and back, and he's the only survivor. This thing just grows like out of control. Like within a matter of a couple of days, it's standing 6 to 7 feet tall. It's huge, very muscular. And again, but this isn't really like a monster. It shows some signs of intelligence. I noticed that was worked into the way, Harryhausen always put a personal touch on his creatures, and he really goes to town on this. A lot of people may disagree with me on this. A lot of us think of the skeleton fight from Jason the Argonauts as one of the best things Harryhausen's even done. Even Harryhausen thinks it's his best work. That whole movie, everything in that movie, he thinks is really cool. And again, the skeleton fight is really cool. But as I really watched this film a couple of days ago, and it's got a great fight scene in there I'm going to talk about in a second here, it's a magnificent stop motion work. And you connect with this thing, with this Venusian, and it sort of displays intelligence. We find out in the movie that it survives on sulfur. That's what it eats. But they can't explain why it's growing so quickly, except that there must be something in our atmosphere that it breathes okay. It can breathe okay. So the oxygen, and all of that, because we know that the atmosphere of Venus is toxic. Of course, we didn't know that back then. So again, that's one of those speculations, I guess, that we have to sort of oversee. But the creature gets loose, gets away. They capture it. They find out that they can paralyze it with electricity, with a large jolt of electricity. They electrify a net and they capture it, and then they keep just enough electricity going into it. So they take it to the big zoo in Rome, where Leonardo works as a zoologist. And they've got it tied up there, and they keep just enough electricity into it to keep it paralyzed and subdued. And as they explain, and you know what's coming here, they give it too much, they'll kill it. If they don't give it enough, it's going to get loose. Well, we know it's going to happen. And through an incredible act of incompetence, they knock the power to it off, and of course it immediately gets loose, and now it's loose in the zoo with all of these people. Not a good thing. But the one thing about this film is that, with a couple of exceptions, it doesn't kill anybody. It meets up with a farmer. It seriously injures him. That's when they capture it. But it doesn't kill anybody. And when it gets loose in the zoo, it pits it against one of the animals there, an elephant. And this is, if you're familiar with this film in any way whatsoever, then you know of the classic elephant emir scene in this movie, and it is one of the best. I still think it is the best thing that Ray Harryhausen's ever done, because he had to make a stop motion elephant. He wanted them to find him a 15-foot high elephant, but they couldn't find one. So the only size elephant they could get in, and again, this was shot in Rome, and it all leads up to the Colosseum, by the way, and it's the actual Colosseum. They actually used it as a location. When this thing is fighting this elephant, it's fighting the stop motion elephant, but when they cut back and forth to the real elephant and the stop motion one, it's seamless. I really, really focused on that scene this time around watching the film, because I've always been fascinated with it, and it is the most incredible fight scene with stop motion creatures that I've ever seen. And of course, the elephant gets killed. Now, when I first saw this movie, I didn't know the elephant got killed, because a lot of local TV stations took that scene out. They were afraid it was too intense for kids, and they knew this was going to be, viewed by a lot of kids. And then those scenes were later put back in. The British version, they totally took scenes like that out, because it would have gotten an X rating over there because of the violence. And those scenes never got put back in until like 2008. So there's some intense scenes in here, but I don't think it's anything that's going to traumatize a child too badly. Again, you know, parents explain to the kids that this is all fantasy. This is all make believe, and these creatures don't exist. The Yeemers don't exist. Elephants do, but it was pretty intense. I remember seeing it again when the scenes were put back in, and I think it was on CBS Late Night when they showed the entire film and seeing the elephant lying there dead. It was, you know, and I was, you know, an older kid by then. I was like, wow. I mean, I could see where it would upset people. Well, they trap the emir in the Colosseum, and that's where I said, you know, didn't kill anybody, but it did kill a couple of soldiers when a couple of big columns busted loose and fell on these soldiers. So, you know, they're going through Rome just destroying things right and left, like most of these movies do. But finally, Hopper and his gang are able to corner the emir, and with a bazooka and some tank fire. You know, this isn't like a Japanese film where none of that stuff works. No, this worked. You know, I mean, bullets didn't work because it was, you know, just, you know, it was too big. You know, it would pop off his skin. But the bazooka round works, and he falls to its death. And that is the end of the emir after they finally have confronted him in this classic scene with the Colosseum. Like I said, folks, I just skimmed right over the story. And again, some of the critics, you know, they liked the film overall, but said that, you know, the story was sort of dopey. Some people have written, you know, like an IMDb of their reviews, you know, where, you know, anyone like you can write a review on these movies. And I read a couple where they said, oh, man, it was so awful. When the monster comes out, then I didn't care. Well, I'm not going to go so far as to say that. It's a typical 1957 monster movie script. And, you know, when the emir comes out, then it's Katie bar the door. Then I'm all in. But the dialogue and the characterizations, and of course Bob Calder and Marissa fall in love, and they, you know, it's implied that they're gonna, you know, live happily ever after, and all of that. And of course the comic book, I'm not going to spoil that, but the comic book takes place 50 years later, and you'll have to find out what they did with the storyline after that, if you can track down a copy of it, because it's well worth reading. I love this film, folks. I always will love this film. I can always get excited talking about it. And I think for those of you who have seen this film, if you meet somebody at a convention or whatever, or you bump into Mark and I or whatever, we get talking about this movie. These are pretty much the things we're going to talk about in the movie, is the emir and the fight scenes and just the phenomenal stop motion animation going on. So that's it for 20 million miles to Earth. And folks, I got thinking, and I got to admit, I'm going to give credit where credit is due. I got a little inspired by Svengoolie. As you know, I'm a huge Svengoolie fan, and Svengoolie is a friend of the show, I should say. He lets us post on his Facebook pages and things. Rich is just a great guy. He's one of the last of the great, great horror hosts that's been around for decades. And every Saturday night, whenever I can, I watch Svengoolie to relive, you know, how it was growing up as a monster kid. And I happened to notice, you know, they were doing Monolith Monsters, which I want to come back and visit. I want to revisit that movie too, because these were all done in 1957, and they're all celebrating their 65th anniversaries. So for the next few weeks or so, and we've got a couple of other fun shows mixed in for you when Mark and Madeline and Clay get available, I'm going to be talking a lot about the films from this year, from 1957, because it was such an incredible year for monster movies and sci-fi. So hope you can look forward to that as we continue on season 7 here on Monster Attack. And folks, thanks for all your support. We actually missed a week 2 weeks ago when I was taken ill, and I appreciate your patience with that and all of the kind wishes. Doing much better. And we're still not really sure what it was that tagged me, except that it was some kind of food poisoning or some kind of toxin that I got exposed to somewhere. But they think food poisoning, maybe salmonella or something. So, but I'm much better in getting my strength back and getting all excited again about talking to you about some monsters here on Monster Attack. Hey, folks, back with you again, I promise, next Monday. Be sure to be there, or be square, as they say, and have a great week.
This Labor Day weekend, fandom is calling. Let Michael, Mike, Darren, and Jen help you answer the call with the latest news, notes, tips, and tricks on the DragonCon Report. Available as an audio podcast, visit DragonConReport.com, and for the first time ever, watch us on video via Facebook Live and YouTube. We want to help you celebrate your fandom in all the best ways. So listen up, and we'll see you at the con.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.